The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 333. Say It Isn't So, The Lord's University, Freedom and Authority at BYU. The authors meet the critics being Paul Richards and Karen D. Austin. Comments by the authors Brian Waterman and Brian Cagle.
And welcome to the session, Say It Isn't So, The Lord's University, Freedom and Authority at BYU. Brian Waterman and Brian Cagle co-authored a book, which was published just this past December, entitled The Lord's University, Freedom and Authority at BYU. They are both former editors of competing BYU publications, and they were later editors at Sunstone Magazine. Brian Waterman was the editor of the Off-Campus Student Review and guest-edited a special student review of Dialogue. He is currently a doctoral candidate in American Studies at Boston University and lives with his wife Stephanie and their two daughters at Cambridge, Massachusetts. Brian is spending the summer as a research fellow at New York Historical Society and Princeton University Library. Brian Cagle edited the Daily Universe at BYU. He received his bachelor's in journalism there and is a graduate student at the University of North Texas. Brian is senior analyst at Blue Cross Blue Shield and lives with his wife Heather and two children in Dallas. Their book will be critiqued by Paul Richards and Karen Austin. Paul, who is retired, is the former media spokesperson for BYU, a position he held for 13 years. He was also former editor of the Provo Daily Herald. He received his BA and MA degrees from BYU. Karen also received BA and MA degrees at BYU in English and rhetoric. She also taught for a year as a faculty member in the English department. She is doing further graduate studies in rhetoric at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee and is director of the Writing Center at Shepherd's College, Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Karen is married to Michael Austin. They have a child, Porter, and they both teach English at Shepherd's College. We will hear first from Paul and then Karen, followed by responses from the authors.
The Lord's University, Freedom and Authority at BYU by Brian Waterman and Brian Cagle is a mix of journalistic style, scholarly documentation, and personal reminiscences. They're both actors in this play that constitute the most important unofficial history of Brigham Young University since the 1985 publication of Brigham Young University, A House of Faith by Gary James Bergera and Ronald Prittis. Signature books published both works. Journalistic style makes for an easy, entertaining read. However, the extensive scholarly documentation of abuses of power at BYU, particularly from 1988 to 98, make the Lord's University a painful and often chilling read. It gets the blood pumping and undoubtedly is a burr under the saddle to those who claim immunity from public scrutiny. As the authors explain, the Lord's University is not a comprehensive history of BYU or of academic freedom issues at the school. They refer to readers to Ernest L. Wilkinson's 1975 official history, Brigham Young University, the First 100 Years, and to the Bergera and Prittis work as indispensable to a more complete study of BYU's history. They do, however, devote nearly 40% of the book's 453 pages to longer chronological discussions of select topics that serve as context for the more recent high-profile controversies. These topics in those earlier chapters are uses of Mormon education, was highly informative, women and feminism at BYU, which is highly enlightening and an area that no one has handled previously in either of the other two works. A Brief History of the Universe, BYU student newspaper, and Making Model Students, the Transformation of the Honor Code. And those chapters bring back a lot of memories to people like me who attended BYU and worked there. I do disagree somewhat in the chapter on feminism. They make a comment about Dallin Oaks saying that he wasn't as responsible in bringing about change for women as some people would think. And that may be true in cases of feminism and so on. But as I recall, Dallin Oaks was a very strong influence, as opposed to Wilkinson, in bringing about an equity and awareness for women. In other words, for people who work there, he initiated programs which still haven't achieved full fruition to bring about equal pay and to bring about respect for women. And I think one of his most well-known speeches is the Shape Up Brethren talk that he gave when some of the brethren, after he had tried to initiate some of these things, still treated women in a very negative way. So I would give Oaks credit, although I do agree somewhat. He may not have been the advocate for feminism, as we know it, that some would like. While the early chapters provide intriguing insights into the character of BYU, the real meat of the book for me is contained in the last six chapters, which deal with such topics as academic freedom and the recent symposia, quote-unquote, statement. The Cecilia Conchar Farr, David Knowlton, Gail Turley Houston, Brian Evanson, Stephen Epperson, and other firings. The Bateman administration's collision with the American Association of University Professors, and the influence of the national neoconservative cultural wars on movement on BYU. The strength of the book lies in the way Waterman and Cagle present so much information about events of the last 10 years, as BYU has embarked on what administrators call a course correction. A correction made necessary because, as one religion faculty member quoted in the book stated, some of the faculty members hired in the late 80s did not have a strong commitment to BYU's mission. The book causes one to wonder how BYU got off course in the first place. For an institution that is so fastidious about protecting its own, the implied criticism of a previous president who is now an apostle seems highly unusual. The book is an excellent example of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts. And for me, what I mean by that is many of us were aware of these events as they happened, especially over the last 10 years. But you read about one instance, and then time passes, you forget, and then another, and another, another. And this is a concentrated dosage all in one place that brings an awareness of a larger trend that you don't get when you think about these individual cases and then somewhat forget about them with the passage of time. The book gives rise, because of this perspective, to speculation that there has been as much, if not more, reputation-damaging controversy in recent years than in any comparable period of time in the school's history, even under Ernest L. Wilkinson. A weakness of the book is the lack of responses from BYU administrators. But, as the authors explain, perhaps future historians will have access to accounts from administrators and board members stories we were denied that will further personalize their involvement in these events. Cagle and Waterman point out that following the publication of the Bergera Pritis book, BYU administrators and librarians were pressured to restrict access to the university's official archives. As a result, they state, we have had to rely on public and private documents made available to faculty members, usually as a result of the continuing status processes. They also conducted numerous interviews and researched extensively in media reports and so forth, coming up with information that has not been previously available to the public, or at least not generally known. I, for one, was not fully aware of the role that a handful of faculty played in fighting the university's unethical conduct in dealing with these faculty members. People like John Hawkins, Bert Wilson, Scott Abbott, Sam Rushforth, Dwayne Jeffrey, Susan Howe, Bill Evanson, and Alan Keel were courageous in actually countering or defending some of these faculty. And in the climate that's there, some of them have paid a price. The young authors document many events that present BYU as a heavy-handed, dishonest, inconsistent, unfair, and inquisitorial body in its dealing with certain faculty. All this goes unanswered by university officials. As one administrator told a faculty member, also quoted in the book, the press does not understand how to deal with issues this complex, referring to the firing of English faculty member Gail Turley Houston. In spite of the lack of the responses from BYU administrators, one administrator and one faculty member told me recently in private that the book is remarkably accurate in its accounts and descriptions of the faculty firings. They, in fact, said that the two authors carried it to a point but couldn't go further because they didn't have this information, and these people could have provided some names and information that would have been helpful. But, of course, they're not free to do so. The fear on the part of administrators of responding to media inquiries and to their inquiries, which they made, is a recurrent theme throughout the book and one I think we're all familiar with. It is so easy to get burned, of course, when you deal with the media. And the media people do have their faults. But to tell reporters, as what one administrator did, that the AAUP report on BYU was full of inaccuracies, and then refused to elaborate because the school, quote, does not conduct our business in the press, actually gives credibility to the report, but they don't seem to understand that. Talk about getting burned. When Stephen Epperson lost his job in the history department, the administration refused to comment other than to say, a faculty member is not in trouble simply because he has a disagreement with his bishop. And you need to get the book and read what all this is about. Some of you may know the story about Steve and his run-in with his bishop. This prompted AAUP members at BYU to observe that the administration seemed to hide behind confidentiality, ironically, as a way of casting doubt on a fired faculty member's moral character. And this is a tactic that's used often, and I've seen it personally. Well, we can't talk about this, but we know things about this person that aren't appropriate to discuss publicly, and that's why we're doing this. And, of course, people say, well, we understand. Go ahead and do what you need to do. Waterman and Cagle cite many examples where faculty and students have been told not to take their grievances to the media. This is another constant theme, it seems, going back to even back to Wilkinson. One such instance occurred when Gail Houston was told that the cause of feminists on campus would not be improved by going to the press. We need to deal with these things privately, internally, and that's another tactic. You can keep it quiet and internal and talk to them. They think they're getting a response, they're getting heard, won't say anything, but nothing ever goes anywhere with that kind of procedure. The issues needed to be treated within the university community. But the book points out going to the media does produce results. The book cites the problems the university created for itself when it fired anthropologist David Knowlton and English faculty member Cecilia Contrafar. The firings were based on alleged inferior scholarship. When the truth came out, as did when they went to the media and provided documentation, it showed that they both were more productive than the majority of the peers they worked with who actually did get promotion or continuing status. The university seemed bent on damaging the professional careers of these two faculty rather than admitting the firings were based on religious grounds, which ironically the university can do. It's just concerned about its image. And so if the university says, we need to fire these people, but if we fire them for, say, religious grounds, it may reflect on academic freedom, and of course it's going to reflect on the church, because where does that directive come from? So they fell into this trap of damaging the reputation of these two faculty members. How strange that an organization that so admirably teaches truth and honesty and the value of individuals would resort to kangaroo court tactics and dissembling to protect itself. And this is all adequately documented in the book. BYU apparently learned its lesson because, as explained in the Lord's University, by the time the Houston case came about several years later, administrators did not try to damage her reputation. They admitted their decision was based on religious grounds. Her feminist views were harmful to students and damaging to the church. Other observations. This book gives a rise to a lot of questions and a lot of observations. The university is always upset about people using anonymous sources. And when I was editor of the paper, we oftentimes had to use anonymous sources because people were afraid to speak unless they could have the protection of anonymity. Merrill Bateman, the president, was very upset when an anonymous source accused him of plagiarism. It's just a constant theme. You know, why can't these people stand up and speak out and have the guts to stand behind what they're saying? I mean, we can't pay attention to them if they aren't going to tell us who they are. But as a case, as in the case of Brian Evanson, whose Altman's tongue caused him to get fired because it was too violent for BYU, an anonymous student complained to the administration. As it turns out, it was Bruce Hafen, the provost's daughter, who was in a class there. This is one of those interesting things that comes out in the book, and there are a lot more of these kinds of things. In that case, Brian Evanson was not allowed to confront his accuser, was not allowed to talk to higher administrative officials, I mean higher up. I mean, obviously, this has gone to church headquarters and back. He was not allowed to do this. And it's pretty much the same case in all of these situations where somebody, a BYU, one or two people, usually a right-wing type, a right a wing nut. complains and says to BYU, why are we allowing this kind of thing to go on here when we are the Lord's university and this is clearly secular humanism or whatever? Why are we allowing this to go on here? And that is then taken anonymously and used against faculty, and they have no recourse. So, you know, all I say is BYU can't have it both ways. If it doesn't want anonymous sources to be used in the paper when they're complaining about BYU, then they pretty dang well better stop using anonymous sources against their own faculty. It's ludicrous. Sorry, I get... I'm supposed to be objective about all this, but this book just raises too many, for me, very painful feelings about how, as I said before, an institution that teaches honesty and integrity and has the honor code, well known, as they point out at BYU, and then you have administrators who obviously, I hate to say it, but it's pretty obvious, they're lying. Another aspect of this that brings out just a minor observation, but an important one. When BYU deals with these people and then there is opposition, there's always this thing, well, it's just a handful of people, just a minority of people, and they really don't count. But that's hard to deal with when you've been raised in a church and it's done a good job with me of teaching us that the one makes a difference. That the individual who stands up and speaks out in spite of ostracism and social pressure and peer pressure. I mean, these lessons go way back. You know, peer pressure. You've got to stand up for what's right. You can make a difference. So it's kind of an anomaly here where they say, well, these are just a few minor irritants, and they call them that. We don't need to spend any time with them because it's just a minority. Look at all the wonderful people we've got here who back us up and think that we're wonderful. And sure, they think they're wonderful. I mean, that's part of the system. And they point this out. Is BYU going to be a comfortable, lazy, happy valley place as opposed to the few who are making waves? And so this aspect of minorities, you see, is not a consistent thing. When they talk about minorities and put them down, when I was taught that a minority pretty much made a difference, and in fact, Mormons are a minority, and we're making a difference in the world. Well, the book contains a small amount of humor.
That's the worst criticism yet.
During the Farr and Knowlton cases, it was rumored that an academic hit list was existed naming BYU faculty that the Board of Trustees wanted ousted. When a reporter, and this reporter I don't think was very bright, I think it was a universe reporter, asked the provost about this matter, he said, "No, we have not been given a letter listing faculty members to be investigated. That's tantamount to saying, I have not had sex with that woman." I don't recall Michael Corleone in The Godfather issuing a document, cutting military orders, or writing a letter when he ordered the murder of his brother Fredo, if you get what I mean by that. Another point of amusement is BYU's statement, and I've heard this over the years, clear back as far as Wilkinson, and it was in Oakes and Holland's administration. and has been repeated with gusto in the Hafen administration. When it comes to matters that really count, our range of uninhibited academic freedom is both broader and richer than at any other institution in the world. In other words, BYU is free to discuss religion. It better be orthodox, but it is free to discuss religion where other universities can't do this. So we have more freedom than any other institution in the world. Contrast that statement with the following argument that was presented at the 1996 preschool conference, as the two Bryans point out. BYU has a moral responsibility to resist the secular forces that have robbed American universities of their religious roots. Full academic freedom can only bring secularization to the university. Well, do they have more academic freedom or don't they? If they argue on one hand that they have more and then say, but full academic freedom could destroy the university, you know, they get caught in their own words here. The contradiction comes in part, I'm just about done here, the contradiction comes in part through the university's course correction that I mentioned before that has taken place in the last 10 years or so, whereby it has taken the conservative side in what 1992 presidential hopeful Pat Buchanan declared as culture wars, a battle for the very soul of the nation. The last chapter in the Lord's University, titled On Culture Wars, Crossroads, and Chartered Courses, is a very interesting and enlightening account of BYU's embracing of the culture war philosophy. It goes a long way in explaining the school's recent disdain toward academe. It appears that BYU no longer is concerned about winning respect in the world of scholarship as it was under Presidents Dallin H. Oaks and Jeffrey R. Holland. Those I consider, in hindsight, some of the golden years in progressing toward an excellent university that I don't think is being strived for anymore. No question, BYU has the right to be academically free to do what it wants to do as a religious university, as opposed to being an institution that promotes academic freedom. Will the current course correction as ascribed in the Lord's University Freedom and the Freedom and Authority at BYU be good for BYU and the church? Waterman and Cagle don't think so, but get the book and decide for yourselves.
Hi, I'm Karen Austin. I just want to talk a little bit at the beginning about my ethos, or like why in the heck I'm on this panel. I could describe reasons in three or four different ways. The first is, as was mentioned in the introduction, I received my bachelor's degree and my master's degree from Brigham Young University. Bachelor's from 80 to 84, a master's 89 to 91. And so I participated, from the students' point of view, for several years in the English department there, and then also just enjoying the environment. In fact, when I first got there, I heard all these rumors about some woman who took a test without any pants on, you know. So
the story's in the book.
Yeah, and it's that's chronicled in the book. So if you want to know more about that, she had a coat on. Over. What happened with that is girls used to have to wear dresses on campus, and then there was some relaxation of that, like they could wear pants in the student center, but they had to wear a dress to take a test. So this girl went to go take a test, and she had jeans on. I think this was a time where they could wear slacks but not jeans. And she didn't have time to go back and change. Pulled her pants off and went in with her overcoat on, with nothing but panties underneath that, and she took the test and passed, and no one carded it, so there was a lot of dialogue about how you can take tests in your panties but not in blue jeans at BYU.
Wait, can I just say,
sure.
when I called her to ask her, I found her. I may have told the alumni relations that I was planning a class reunion. I don't remember how I got. I found out where she was, and I called her, and she sort of had a different name. The name that she wrote the letter under was A. LaVon Bryan. A. LaVon Bryan. And she was listed as Anita Welsh now, and that's her married name. And I called her, and I said, I'm looking for LaVon Welsh. And she said, LaVon? And then she went, because she knew her real name. I mean, she went by Anita, but she signed the letter A. LaVon using her middle name because she didn't want to get too much flack. I mean, little did she know she was going to get national media coverage. But she said anytime someone calls and asks for LaVon, she knows that they're trying to find out if she's the one who pulled her pants off to take the test.
So, I could speak from my perspective as a student at Brigham Young University. Also, my master's work was in literature and rhetoric, and I wrote my master's thesis on the way the debate was framed in the culture wars in the 80s, but particularly surrounding the publication of two histories of American literature, one from Cambridge and one from Columbia, and all the really intense debate among academics on how to arrange and organize and narrate what constitutes American, and I sought to analyze those from a rhetorician's point of view, specifically the metaphors that different scholars took on. So then also another interest I have related to this is I did my graduate work in rhetoric and composition in Milwaukee, and not only did I get a chance to study language and especially, you know, during culture wars, but doing this in Milwaukee, I also had the experience of frequently receiving little news clippings in my inbox about all these things going on at BYU from the Chronicle of Higher Education and so forth. Sometimes people would actually talk to me about all of this, but more often I would just get little news clippings thrown into my box. As if I were, like, responsible for everything that happened at BYU. And one of the most interesting discussions I had during that time, oh, and by the way, I'm ABD, it was really nice for the person introducing me to make it sound like I'm finishing, but I'm not. I had a student confront me and say, I hear you went to BYU, but, you know, you're getting your PhD, so, you know, still believe in God, do you? And it was just an interesting, I'm like, okay, I have to take a language exam, complete my coursework, give up God, pass my orals. I didn't see that. So this kind of tension, freedom and authority, can be experienced from different viewpoints. So I have a big investment in trying to reconcile these conflicts. I also was a one-year faculty appointment from the academic year 1991-1992. I was managing the Reading Center and teaching classes in composition theory. And so I attended faculty meetings and got to see people coming in for job interviews who did presentations. And I was in the faculty retreat mentioned in the book when Cecilia was there, where we were all trying to have a healing moment and talk and get off. We didn't get off campus because people were too cheap to do that, but get out of the English building and try to talk to each other as, amigos and brothers and sisters, and how difficult that was. I'd also walk down the halls of the JKHB, and people would almost literally leap out of their offices and pull me and close the door and ask me which side I was on, you know. So are you one of us or one of them? And it was a very difficult climate because I was really trying to seek a moderate position, but it was really hard to do that because if you didn't take stand one way or the other, then you were suspect. Your loyalty was suspect. And I was thinking about getting my PhD and trying to come back and run the Writing Center, so I didn't want to do anything to piss people off, you know. But the position I want to take is one of a reader. In fact, I wrote an abstract for Albert saying, I want to do a panel Cliff Notes from the Harried Mormon Housewife. And this was one of the four books I was going to review, but Albert emailed me back and asked me if I could just make a commitment to one book and be on this panel. So it's really from that viewpoint as a lay reader outside of the Utah BYU community, because I'm now living in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. I haven't been in Utah since 1992. So it's from that position that I want to give you all my responses to this book. First, let me talk about what I liked about the book. First of all, it was in print, okay? Living outside, of Zion, I heard a lot about, Cecilia and Gale and other things going on campus, like Evanston. But I did so primarily through email, Lifeline for somebody in rural West Virginia, and telephone conversations with people, or I'd occasionally travel and sit in people's living rooms, and we'd have like little gossip bashes about what's going on at BYU. In fact, my friends who don't go to BYU were just like, will you shut up about this already? But I was just really eager to kind of see what was going on there, because it really represented for me how academics in the church, faculty members, administrators, and students can talk about issues, contemporary issues, and learn and take, political positions, and what consequences those could end up being, and what policies were being generated to kind of shepherd this environment. And by just talking to people in their parlors and chatting on email, I was never quite sure how much was hyperbole, who was, being quoted. And so I was always kind of very, very interested, but very suspect. So I was really happy to see accounts in the book. They have a lot of sources. They, refer to AP articles and other print journalism. They interview people directly. They talk about surrounding events that kind of set this tone, like the White Roses campaign and Michael Quinn and the September 6th. And so there was a lot of documentation about, like, meetings and speeches and people getting called in by their state presidents and policies being generated at BYU, like your bishop can get you fired now, faculty have to go through an ecclesiastical endorsement every year, so you can lose your job and your church membership, like, all in the same week. So I was very happy to see a collection of, and I really feel as though the authors were earnest, as they said in their introduction, to try to get as many sources as they could to represent as many facts over this 15-20-year period as they could collect. They had some restrictions on that, and that's apparent as you read through, but I do believe that they were really earnest and diligent in trying to accumulate as much objective evidence, facts, testimonies, sources as they could muster. I was very grateful for that. Now I'll talk about a couple of things that concerned me, and then the last thing I want to talk about is just the conflict itself, the freedom and authority conflict, and kind of how this gets played out in the language of the book. As a person who studies rhetoric and teaches composition, you can take several different stances on how you analyze a text and what areas of a text are more important to you. And like, I've had some teachers really interested in style, how the sentence level and how many clauses and all these things like that. I'm really interested in organization, and so I really looked at the table of contents and the organization within chapters. And what Brian do is they do a mix between chronological and thematic. And in one sense, it's really nice to see the chronology. The first few chapters they give a greater background about the Wilkinson years and then go on to the 80s and 90s, and in each chapter it's more or less chronological, but then there are chapters that kind of overlap their chronology and take on themes instead. So Under Fire, the Farr and Knowlton cases, or Dirty Laundry, Dangerous Words, the Houston and Evanston cases. And so I found myself wanting Levina Anderson's chronology that I talk about, or a more developed one. I really wish, I kept looking in the back, I'm like, oh, to be an appendix within a chronology here. And I would have actually typed one up, but I didn't think about doing it until I was three-fourths of the way through, because I was trying to keep in mind what happened first and second, and when people would pronounce certain policies and people would get in trouble, or people would get in trouble, and then later the policy was announced, or who was meeting with whom, when, and where. And I think, you know, if I would have written this book, I would have had the same problem trying to organize the information partly thematically, partly through chronology, because both perspectives are really inviting. And they do a pretty good job cross-referencing. They'll put little parentheses all throughout the chapters. For more of this, see chapter 7. So that's helpful. And as Paul spoke, as far as the first part of the book, there's so much about Wilkinson in the beginning. I found myself, if I hadn't been reviewing this book, I would have just flipped right over that. And in fact, talking to people who have read the book, they start with the juicy stuff about the 80s and the 90s, and they leave all that other stuff behind. So I kept asking myself, why are they doing this? Why are they doing this? Well, when they had access to his journals, and that wasn't something they always had access to, they didn't have that much access to materials from the Board of Trustees or the administrators at BYU. So part of the reason I felt they were doing it just because they had it. But I do think that there was also an implicit argument being made that kind of like the McCarthyism of the Wilkinson era set a tradition for BYU administrators, and that's still being carried through. But I think on the one hand, they sought to be objective and just factual, so they don't overtly draw a lot of these moral lessons that are kind of implied by what materials they put in there and how they organize some other things. So I'd be interested to hear why they did that. And if anybody read 1-5 straight through, anybody who's bought the book, it's interesting, but I had to make myself do it. So the panel description asks a question: is it possible for them to be objective given that they were participants in this? It's slanted, and they tell you that at the very end of their preface. They say, we really try, but you know, we probably are a little biased. And part of the reason why it's slanted is that they believe that if you just display all the facts and give all the information that's available, then the truth will emerge. But see, that already gives a bias to the whole value of academic discourse and the project of journalism and democracy and dialect. So it's on that topic that I want to close my observations. I see from their subtitle they give you a binary, freedom and authority at BYU. And that really is what organizes much of the book, even though there is the chronology and the thematic topics going through the chapters. It's really trying to describe and document a tension and to name that tension. And I think those who chose to not be interviewed or print records about this would say that as well, but that's the entire issue here, is the terms you use to name that tension. And so I just want to go through a list of some things I compiled while I was reading the book, and part of this is what I've observed just as a student during the culture wars. So one of the book's main tensions that it describes is conservative versus liberal, but I keep trying to imagine what a book would look like by someone from the conservative point of view who want to document the same 20-year period, and they wouldn't even cast this in terms of conservative, say, devout versus rabble-rousers, okay? So and that's part of where the conflicts come in the book. Has anybody taken a progressive or a liberal stance on a number of issues is labeled a rabble-rouser or a troublemaker. In fact, I remember the first time I met Cecilia, speaking of rabble-rousers, I was in the elevator, and she didn't know who I was. I was riding down the elevator. She was just making a big stink about where her office was, and located because it was far away from everybody else. It was in the summer before she even started. And she just had this stance coming out of graduate school that activism was a way to make change within organizations. And I just thought, you know, that right there is a conflict about how change is conducted within an organization. So there's a real tension there. On the one side, change is made from the top down. You know, people at the top get a vision, they give orders and instructions to others, and that's taken down the chain of the command. Where activism sees that the people who are living the experience, who eat, breathe, and drink whatever social problem exists, voices that problem and communicates that and seeks to make changes in policies. So there's a shift in how people strive for change. And again, if you're an activist, you're a rabble-rouser and a bad person and disobedient, you know. Well, another tension I see is all conflict is bad, and BYU's desire and the Board of Trustees' desire to keep a lot of this conflict out of the media shows that. Also, people, the Clothesline Project that is documented in here, this was so amazing to me. I heard about this on email, but to see some of this printed up. People would complain about the Clothesline Project. This is where victims of rape and sexual abuse would express their rage for being victims by writing on shirts and putting them on a clothesline, like airing dirty laundry. And this is a national project, and BYU had a display of this 2 or 3 years, and it caused a lot of problems. And some people would write letters to the editor, the Daily Universe, or complain higher up the chain of command and say that this display is full of hate, bitterness, and an unforgiving heart. How dare these rape victims show rage when this is the Lord's University and we're supposed to forgive our enemies? You know, so conflict is not a good thing. It shows, you know, contention and a bad spirit, and where the kind of liberal progressive side sees that what you're supposed to seek in order to run a community successfully is to look for those points of tensions and those conflicts and focus on them and articulate them and name and describe them and problem solve them and engage everybody in the discussion to try to address the tensions and the conflicts. The notion of, I've kind of talked about this already, the way knowledge is constructed or created, or the epistemology would be the philosophical term, the epistemology of how knowledge is generated in a religious community is one that's based largely on witnesses. We have the Holy Ghost, we have authorities like prophets and apostles, and people who have the authority to receive a witness will articulate that witness, and then other people are supposed to obey that witness, where and that witness is kind of put in a hierarchy. And I don't think that always happens in religious communities, but it's happened in ours, where the witness is put in a hierarchy rather than everybody getting personal revelation. And so the more liberal position that taken in this book shows a belief that debate, dialogue, and communication should be, it's that process that is almost holy, if you will. You know, it's that belief that human beings, through communication, can help their communities function more effectively. So yeah, it's biased because it believes in communication and dialogue and debate, and not in keeping quiet and doing what the authorities have to say to do by their witnesses based on their authority. There's a tension between doing things that are good for the group, for the institution, versus doing things that are good for preserving the freedom of the individual. You might have to make a sacrifice for the group as a whole in order to preserve freedoms of the individual. So there's a tension there. One of the ways to name this tension has been published in an article by Matthew Arnold called Hebraism and Hellenism. And when I was at BYU, the director of the Reading Center, Joyce Hooker, had me read this article, and she gave it to the reading tutors a lot to practice a concept called mapping. And really interesting tension about the way knowledge and communities function on a Hebrew model versus a Hellenic or Greek model. And I was always very fascinated by that article because I really felt like Brigham Young University, by being a church school, was trying to exist within that tension. Okay, and sometimes we see this in Sunday school. You get up and it's a school, and you're trying to do academic things, but if you ask really hard questions about stuff, then people can, like, flip out. Is that in the manual? You know, so there's an articulation of that conflict by Matthew Arnold. Hugh Nibley would describe a conflict, but his term is mantic versus sophic, and when I started playing that conflict out, I started thinking, no, it's not manic. Okay, that's the mantic, that's the kind of charismatic spiritual experience where it's a illogical kind of stance because you get so overpowered by the spirit that it's not through rational inductive or deductive reasoning that you receive revelation or conduct yourself as a spiritual person. And I was trying to write things out as mantic versus sophic, but it's bureaucratic versus sophic is the tension that's going on. I'm seeing a view of religion that's becoming more and more follow the brethren. I mean, that's the religious lesson being taught, is not follow the Spirit, follow personal revelation, follow Christ, follow the atonement, but it's follow the brethren, follow the brethren, follow the brethren. And I just happen to believe that developing moral nature is much more complicated than saying, yes, sir. My mom's on a mission at Temple Square right now. My stepfather's in the temple presidency there. Sorry if this is on the tape, Gary. Sorry I said that. We have talks about this all the time, and my mom's like just really upset that I would criticize the brethren, you know. But Bateman's a general authority, you know. So just last night I was getting ready to do this talk, and she's just so disturbed that I'm doing this. And I was talking to her about my view of what life's mission is, about developing a moral character so that you know how to make moral judgments. And I talk to my bishop. I'm not a big troublemaker. I really am pretty, you know, keep my ducks in a row. But I really, really do believe that developing moral character is much more complicated than saying yes, sir. And I do think there are some times where to develop moral character, the difficult thing to do is to say yes and to be humble. Sometimes it is, but it's not always. It's not like this automatic response. You have to think and make a judgment. So there's that tension there about how to respond to authority and how to develop moral character. What I was really interested in, and I just moved and I was like digging through everything, trying to find my old ensigns. I remember, I think it was the 1988 presidential election, the Ensign published two articles. They were reprints of talks asking people to participate in government, okay, would never say politics because that's already a weighted term, but how to participate in your government. And there was a talk by Oakes and a talk by Faust side by side, and these two talks showed this tension. Faust talked about how we live in the world, we are not of it, we have to suffer the political system, we need to know that our moral character comes from God and our church system, and you go and you vote with a good conscience and you do what you are to do as a saint. Primarily, and the divine governing order is a theocracy, and we need to remember that and not be sullied by these other views of government. And then, turn the page, there's Oakes. We participate in a democracy, we rejoice in the chance to throw our voice in with pluralism, and we believe in the project of democracy, and that truth will prevail. You know, if democracy is preserved, and it was just amazing to me to see these published side by side in the Ensign that contradicted each other. So this tension exists in many places in many ways. So I invite you to read this book as a collection of sources and a meditation on these conflicts that can be named in various different ways, as an act of activism, too. I mean, I know Brian and Brian, and when I was reading, like, the more moderate, tempered ones, I'm like, oh, there's Cagle, trying to be very diplomatic. And then when it was like, once more into the breach, wah! There's Waterman, you know, like, he was really trying to rein it in, but, you know, give it up. But I applaud them for their work to collect these sources and for their dedication to try to promote dialogue. And thank you very much for your time.
I just I made a couple notes on things, on specific points that that people made that I thought that I might have either an answer or an explanation or try to justify my sins or something. But I'll just kind of go through those in the order that I made them. First of all, oh, can you hear? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought this one worked. Oh, you want a scene? I want to be like the Holy Spirit or something. Just like. First of all, thank you very much. This was so fun. I thought. Sometimes when I think about the fact that there's a book out there, like someone will send me email and say, I just read this book, and, you know, can you send me this source that you cited? And I'm like, no, can you pay the postage? And and people always were wanting to get it, like, you know, 2 years in advance. I know you're writing this book. Can I have your manuscript? No. But it's amazing to me sometimes to think that it's out there and people are reading it, and then to have people like make intelligent commentary on it. It was fine. It was fun, and I can't think of two approaches and people that would be more fun to listen to. So, Paul brought up the point about Oaks and feminism. This is one of my favorite chapters to write in this book, and maybe because it had less to do with what I lived through. So in a way, it was less personally wrenching. And also because I stumbled upon an amazing cache of sources about feminism in the 1970s that had just been hiding unorganized in file cabinets in an office at BYU. And so I spent all day photocopying them, and it's amazing stuff. So there's a plug for that chapter, and it's in the first five chapters, which Karen was kind of down on. The take on Oaks, I'm going to defer to Paul about Dallin Oaks' personal views on women faculty members, because Paul knows him much better than I do, obviously, and worked with him, and so I think that he's probably better able than I am to judge. The reason I wanted to scale back a little bit from the view that had been taken of Oaks's view toward women is that in all the previous histories, you hear tons about, you know, first there's Wilkinson. We know Wilkinson was just, you know, like a woman hater or whatever. I mean, like, he was trying to come up with ways to keep women from being able to teach there, and, you know, make secretaries wear, you know, dresses in the middle of the winter, and anything he could think of to make women uncomfortable, I think he probably was in favor of. And then the way that these histories are told is then you have Dallin Oaks, and it's like, he's young, he's hip, you know, he still had a little hair. he was coming from Chicago. He was a law professor. He had been on the board of dialogue when it started, and he's, you know, he's the good guy, and he set himself up this way too. I mean, and an interesting pattern we found is that Oaks would rhetorically distance himself from Wilkinson by saying, I will not have the tape measure be a symbol of my administration, you know, in reference to Wilkinson's tendency to follow young, pretty women around on campus, and like, and he even writes these memos. He said, I followed a woman around on campus today, and I followed her into the administration building, and I got up and I told her, you know, by golly, your skirt's too short. And then he always added this little punchline. I don't know if it's just his sense of humor. And he says, and the disgusting thing about it is all she had nothing to show but a pair of stilts. I mean, you know, so not only was she wearing too short of skirts, but she had bad legs to boot. But so Oaks would say, I'm not going to have the tape measure be symbol of my administration. But then he not only preserved all of Wilkinson's codes, but he tightened them as well. And so on one hand, he's like distancing himself from Wilkinson. On the other hand, he's tightening things down. I would like to ask Paul if there's any sense that part of what motivated Oaks to address women's concerns is the fact that we're talking about the 1970s here. We've got the Education Amendment Acts, we've got Title IX, which of course drove him up the wall. I mean,
And there's a sense that you're going to have to change the way you treat women or else you're going to get sued. And that's the bottom line. But the real reason I wanted to scale back from seeing Oakes as the champion of women's rights at BYU is that part of the documentation that I found was that there was a committee. It was his. They eventually were called his advisory committee on women's concerns. Margaret Hoops, Jan Tyler, Reba Keel were the three main people, and these women kicked butt. I mean, they were so great. No one ever wrote about what they did, and there were talk about administrators plagiarizing. There's a place where they present him with an overview of women's concerns at BYU, and they give him this long report. They're so eager, and the scary thing was it sounded exactly like the same things that Cecilia and Gail and everyone else asked for. I mean, 20 years, there was just not a lot of difference in the things that these people are asking for. And they really tell him, you know, we've got to deal with students, with female students, and encourage their education and not just, you know, not just have them here so the men can have somebody to date and marry and drop out of school and raise their babies. I mean, we want women to be educated. And they gave him this report, and then Oakes, to his credit, I mean, it is to his credit that he did this. He made several very important speeches to faculty and even to students about women's education. He relied extremely heavily on their report in a lot of the things that he said. In some places, he even said, like they say to him, we call this concept life planning, and female students need life planning at BYU. And in his speech, he says, I like to call this concept life planning. So the revelation to me was that I had read his speeches before. They're published. They're all over. You can get them in the library. They're quoted in all the old histories. What had not been quoted in all the old histories was the fact that this amazing group of women, two of whom left BYU in utter frustration and despair that things would ever change, really was the force that motivated a lot of what he did say in those speeches. And I thought that they deserved a bit of credit for some of what happened. I'm going to move quickly through a couple other points that I wanted to respond to. One, the issue of administrator stories. We didn't have access to the administrator stories. When we were writing the book, I thought of it as being similar to the Mark Hoffman things. You have several books come out about the Hoffman forgeries, and there are people doing interviews, doing their best, you know, scrambling to get all the documentation they can, but they don't have Gordon Hinckley's day planner. And then eventually, the church allows a church historian to write the church's side of the story, and President Hinckley turns over his day planner, or at least parts of it, so that you do eventually get some of these sources. You know, Rex Lee, before he died, made a series of cassette tapes, like he recorded sort of a memoir of his administration. At least this is the story that I've heard from several people, and was completely candid about the Farrah Knowlton firings. We obviously didn't have access to those cassette recordings, and someone may 50 years from now, and 50 years from now, they may be able to write and tell us, you know, which administrators were worse than others, and who was probably quite disturbed. And it's true that we, in those chapters we write on the 70s, there was a sense of jubilation in having access, thanks to the research that was done for BYU, a house of faith. We were able to have access to Board of Trustees minutes and through Oakes' tenure and also to Wilkinson's journals. And you get a sense from those documents that nothing is ever monolithic. Karen's right. There's a sense in our book that it's BYU versus, you know, BYU versus the good guys. And from those earlier chapters, we really were able to get an insight into the fact that these administrations aren't monolithic. And there are probably people in the Lee administration and the Bateman administration and maybe even Lee himself, Paul Slifton called it the Hafen administration. I thought that was probably apt. But Oh, it was on purpose. But there, I think that there were probably people who were quite disturbed with what was happening, and we just don't know, we just won't know that sort of thing. Someone said that, someone made a joke and said that we were the, you know, we were President's Men of BYU or whatever. And I think that there's a difference there in regard to the types of sources that we were able to use. We probably relied 80% on printed sources, memos, letters, people's notes that they took on meetings, and print media, to the 20% of interviews. And we were very limited in the number of interviews we were able to do, because by the time we were really into the deep into it, into the writing, we were removed from Utah, and it made it difficult to do that. At one point, we had a list of all of the people, like, you know, like all the president's men, you know, we could have been out knocking on doors and saying, you know, just tell me this, just tell me now, you know, will you just confirm this? And we could have done that, and we didn't. And somebody may do that someday, and it'll be more fun to read. But so that's, I mean, there are reasons in addition to the fact that the administrators wouldn't sit down and chat with us. The one time I met with Merrill Bateman, he said, well, I said, I have a list of questions I'd like to ask you, and he'd say, well, I'd rather not answer them, and you can just go with what you have. And this is like the same man who gets up at the pulpit at the, you called it the preschool conference. That's another funny one. The preschool conference. And he gets up and says, you know, the media, they're half-truths, and they never tell our side of the story, and they don't know, but, you know, I gave him a chance, and he didn't take it. I do need to make one correction to one of Paul's comments, and I've realized in retrospect that it's a confusing passage in the book. It's in the portion about Brian Evanson. There's a scene where Brian Evanson and his dad are in a meeting with Hafen, and it comes out that Hafen had his attention brought to the book by his daughter, who was in a class that Brian Evanson spoke to. Now, it's all, to be fair to her, I think that her final decision was that Brian had undertaken a moral project with his fiction, and she was less disturbed by it in the end than her dad was. But she was not the anonymous letter writer, and it's a confusing passage in the book. She brought Hafen's attention to the book. The anonymous letter writer was another person in the same class who wrote a letter. So they were two separate things, but in the context of this meeting and their discussion, it goes back and forth between the anonymous letter writer and the student who brought Hafen's attention to it. And the student who brought Hafen's attention to it was his daughter. But the daughter was not the letter writer. So to be fair to her, I better put that on the record. I think that it says that if you read it, but I can see how it would be easy for people to make that mistake. Let's see. As far as the question of who wrote what and whether Brian is, with a Y, is rushing to the ramparts and the other Brian is the moderate, you know, he's the journalist and I'm a literary critic and whatever. But whether Brian's more reserved, we're not going to tell who wrote what. And everyone who's tried to tell me which chapters we wrote gets some of them wrong. So I feel pretty good about the fact that you can't tell exactly who wrote what. And so if you want to guess, then maybe I'll, you know, pay me money and I'll tell you who wrote which. But this leads to a major point that Karen made about the chronology versus the thematics. And part of the difficulty in organizing this book actually had the added complication of having two authors. And we would very often send our chapters back to each other and find out that we had both written about the same thing. And so we would end up removing one of our accounts so that we didn't overlap. And there, this sometimes contributes to the difficulty with chronology, because you get stories about the summer of 1993 in three different chapters. And I can see, I agree with Karen that we should have done a little timeline. And if you want to do that and publish it on the web, more power to you. But I'm done with this thing. This was 5 years of my life that I wouldn't... I don't know if I would have the energy to do it again. But if someone else wants to do the chronology, then go right ahead. Send me a copy. Thanks.
I want to join Brian in thanking Paul and Karen for their thoughtful responses. It's nice to know that at least two people have read the book. We actually have had a couple of other people give us some feedback, and one of the things that I've heard a couple of different times is the book comes across as one damn thing after another.
One person who read the manuscript wrote that at the top of a chapter. ODTA. One damn thing after another.
I think it's a valid criticism, honestly. We were so close. Go ahead. Did you want to chime in?
Oh.
We were so close to the topic. We had both lived it from different perspectives, of course. I was in front of the camera, and he was... I was behind the camera, and he was in front of the camera. He was the activist, the fiery one. I'm the moderate and temperate one. I was working for the Universe, and he the activist student review. And so as we launched into this project, and we had boxes and boxes, tens of boxes of files and newspaper articles and memos that we were sorting through and trying to make sense of, and the interviews, and also Gary and Ron were very generous to open up their files to us, and some of the earlier chapters rely on a lot of work that they did in research. And so, we did get bogged down in the details, and it does come across as one damn thing after another sometimes. And really, my only response to that is, we could have used a good editor. So. No, I think if you persevere and you skim the parts that bog you down a little bit, and there should only be a few, especially if you read that final chapter that kind of makes sense of the whole thing and places it in the larger context of what's going on in academia and conservative culture, you'll find the payoff is worth it. I don't have a lot to add to what Brian very well covered, but just a few minor points. Paul mentioned that the book was painful to read, indeed the events were painful to live through and cathartic to write about. I ran into David Knowlton yesterday, and he apologized up and down that he hadn't had the chance to crack the book, and that sort of went on to, whatever else he was talking about. And then he returned and he goes, "Oh, got to tell you, I lied to you. It would be too painful to read. I'm trying to move on, and I really don't want to reopen that. And, maybe sometime I will." Really, I don't have a good response to that. I talked to another couple of people who haven't been able to read the book, but they said they found it very cathartic to buy the book.
And it's for sale out on the table.
And maybe and we're going to be signing afterwards. And I don't know anything more like a healing touch than a signed copy of the book on a dusty bookshelf.
Yeah, only one of us drives a little red BMW.
And no Freudian comments, please. Let's see. I did want to clarify one point. I think it was Paul who talked a little bit about the BYU archives and some of the limited access that we had. Like Brian mentioned, we were in Provo for, you know, a period of time while we finished our degrees, and then we spiraled off in other directions. And, you know, as we were writing this thing, inevitably big holes would emerge. And I took one or two research trips back to Utah to, you know, go dig back into the archives at BYU. And the, you know, one of those return trips, I had heard from Brian or Levina or somebody that they had really clamped down, and they probably were not going to give me access to the stuff that I needed to fill in these glaring holes. And so, you know, I went in, you know, with a story in place, and I was going to not really lie, but probably lead him down a path that wasn't quite accurate. And I talked to the guy and, you know, said, you know, these are the files that I need. And he said, what do you need them for? And I said, I need them for a project. And he said, are you here at BYU? And right then I was. Yes, sir. And he said, okay, great. Is this for, they were communication files, is this for some kind of a journalism class? And I go, a journalism project. So he pulled all the files out, and I was elated, of course, because now I could go and fill in these gaps. But that really weighed on me, too, for a couple of reasons. All right, I'm not the most ethical guy in the world. I'm a journalist, okay? but, you know, I knew that the damn book was going to come out, and he'd see all that research in it, and he'd know that he had given me access to it, and this wasn't really a class project. You know, the book was going to be published in 3 months, and, you know, this guy's going to, you know, sue me or at least badmouth me, and so I, you know, I felt really bad. That doesn't happen often. And so I, you know, worked through about half the files, and then I went back to the guy, and I said, you know, can I talk to you privately for a minute? And he said, sure. So we went back into his office, and we sat down, and I was really jittery, you know, because I thought I was going to lose the other half of my research. But it was a price I was willing to pay. I just needed to come clean to this guy. And I said, I lied to you or misled you when I got these files. I'm working on a book. We have a publisher. Its signature. I said that with pride, but also knowing how he would interpret that. I said, you know, it's a book on academic freedom at BYU. We're going to be covering some of the, you know, recent events, Farr, Knowlton, and this is some background information. You know, what are you going to do? And, you know, he said, I appreciate your candor, and I only ask that you try to be fair and you try to show some compassion and some charity, and send me on my way. And, you know, I think, you know, I think that was the hardest thing to do in this book, to show the compassion and the charity and the care, because we were so close to the players in this who were so damaged and are still damaged and are still recovering. And the people that did this to them, it's pretty easy to demonize them, especially when you've got all the documentation to damn them. And I don't know how successful we were. I heard that one particular administrator feels like he was really unfairly characterized. And, you know, that may be true. You select quotes. You bookend quotes. You put things in context. You're missing half the story because you don't have access to the person. And there's nothing that can really be done about it, but that is something that does weigh on me, because when putting this book together, we are playing with people's lives. We are dealing with people's lives. That having said that, Paul, I'd love to have your sources when we do the Lord's Universe 2. Who can fill in half of that, the other half of that. So we'll talk later. You're no longer an active journalist, so I think you can reveal anything you want. The other thing that I want to respond to, and really this is the most important thing I wanted to say, that lack of humor criticism really offends me. There are a number of... How much time do we have?
We only have about 10 minutes. Okay,
I'm going to really wrap this up so you all can
just
ask some questions.
Tell the funniest moment.
Okay, here's my evidence. There's a great story in the book about when the BYU security officers were, you know, cleaning out some houses that had been, you know, narked on by, you know, some overzealous freshman or something. And they found a marijuana plant, like a, you know, a high thing, you know, 5 feet high or something ridiculous. And, you know, they confiscated the plant. It sat in the office, this police office there on campus, you know, for a while, and I guess no one knew what to do with it, or they forgot what it was or something. And Christmas rolled around, and, you know, the little thing's growing and growing, and... the police chief is too cheap to buy a Christmas tree, so the officers there decorated the marijuana plant. They've got lights and tinsel, and they probably flocked the damn thing, I don't know. And no doubt with the lights and the, you know, electricity, the thing's starting to simmer, and they're all feeling the holiday spirit. I you can't hold me to that last part. I don't know that for sure. That, a Daily Universe reporter, and I thought you unfairly characterized Universe reporters are not all dumb.
I'm too, Paul.
That's how I know.
A Universe reporter got wind of this, grabbed a photographer, they snapped a photo of the thing and ran it on the front page of the Universe. Of course, you know, well, I don't know what percentage of BYU students know what marijuana looks like, but when I was there, it was pretty high. It sent the Universe machine into a frenzy, and the local TV stations descended. And were you there then, Paul? And Paul said something, you know, pretty intelligent, like, well, you've got to dry this stuff out before it's smokable. It's not like... I made that up, too. Anyway, there is humor in the book. I love the roach story, you know, where they find roaches. A couple of custodians find roaches running all over the Cougarite. And... you know, they get together and they write a op-ed column, publish it in the Universe, and then their supervisors, you know, send them out letters and fire them, and then, you know, there's a big protest on campus and people in roach costumes marching around, and they walk up to the Cougarite and the Creameria ice cream place, and I'd like Rocky Roach, please, and, you know, the media's all there covering it, and... And the quote from the, it was Brent Harker, who was the PR guy at the time. The quote from him is, okay, you know, so they were fired for their jobs, and all of these people criticized them for, of course, you know, firing these people who were just expressing their opinion in the press. And the quote was something like, well, they do have freedom of speech. They had the freedom to go and talk to their supervisors. Anyway, they were reinstated. There is humor in the book, and I know there's not much time for questions, and I apologize. There were a few other things that I wanted to cover, but I'll let y'all have a minute to talk.
we do have 10 minutes, and in the interest of time and for the benefit of people listening to the tape, please come to the microphone to ask your questions. That will save time.
Well, our editor is raising his hand back there. He might want to defend himself.
Any of you who want to know which chapters Brian Cagle wrote, I'd be happy to tell you afterwards. But I do this question is for anybody who wants to answer it. But I am curious, Paul, you touched on this, and Brian, you touched on it too. Since the book has come out, what have you heard from BYU administrators, either directly or indirectly, people who were quoted in the book, people who weren't quoted in the book? What kind of things have you been hearing about that?
Nothing. I heard just that one, you know, through the grapevine, that one administrator felt he was very unfairly characterized, and I'm not going to mention a name.
Well, this was actually a lower level administrator in a department who I heard. I just heard word from another professor that a certain professor felt like he was mischaracterized. But I've also heard from people. I've seen. Some email conversation about it, and I'm not sure if people realized that I was either a member of the discussion list that they were emailing their opinions about the book to or not, but so I've heard some people talk about it on email, and people who teach there or used to teach there, and a lot of them say it was amazing to read an account of a meeting that I sat through, and in most of those cases the people say, and you know, it was described accurately. So I was a little nervous knowing that there are all these people out there who, you know, hundreds of people whose names I don't know, who were present at some of these things and could maybe, that had a different perspective. But the few that I've heard back from, including a member of one of the committees who reviewed Cecilia Farr, and they said that they thought that those things were portrayed accurately. So that's... I heard from Paul that other thing.
Adam Martin, I write for Student Review. From Provo, graduated from BYU. This is a comment, and then I'll leave it for you to answer if you want. It seems like shouldn't professors know what they're getting into when they come to BYU? I go to BYU. I knew there was an honor code. You know, I know what I'm getting into when I go there. I know what's expected of me. Shouldn't these professors know those kinds of things about BYU before they are running into problems?
What year did you start?
94, 95.
You're already 2 years into this. So you're entering BYU at a time that it's already very clear where we're headed. And in contrast, Cecilia Farr and David Knowlton, the one point that I think I could have made in the book We could have done this a little more firmly, is point out that at most universities, junior-level faculty are encouraged to keep their heads low.